Priest interpreted this as a caution to him to tell the truth, and tell it quickly. Blackthorn had asked for a chair, but the priest said the Japanese did not use chairs, and there were none in Japan. Blackthorn was concentrating on the priest as he spoke to the daimyo, seeking a clue, a way through this reef. There's arrogance and cruelty in the daimyo's face, he thought. I'll bet he's a real bastard. The priest's Japanese isn't fluent. Ah, see that? Irritation and impatience. Did the daimyo ask for another word, a clearer word? I think so. Why is the Jesuit wearing orange robes? Is the daimyo a Catholic? Look, the Jesuit's very deferential and sweating a lot. I'll bet the daimyo's not a Catholic. Be accurate. Perhaps he's not a Catholic. Either way, you'll get no quarter from him. How can you use the evil bastard? How do you talk direct to him? How are you going to work the priest? How discredit him? What's the bait? Come on, think. You know enough about Jesuits. The daimyo says hurry up and answer his questions. Yes, of course, I'm sorry. My name's John Blackthorn. I'm English, pilot major of a Netherlands fleet. Our home port's Amsterdam.
Fleet? What fleet?
You're lying. There's no fleet. Why is an Englishman pilot of a Dutch ship? All in good time. First, please translate what I said.
Why are you the pilot of a Dutch privateer? Hurry up!
Blackthorn decided to gamble. His voice abruptly hardened and it cut through the morning warmth. Keva! First translate what I said, Spaniard! Now! The priest flushed.
I'm Portuguese. I've told you before. Answer the question.
I'm here to talk to the daimyo, not to you. Translate what I said, you motherless offal! Blackthorn saw the priest redden even more, and felt that this had not gone unnoticed by the daimyo. Be cautious, he warned himself. That yellow bastard will carve you into pieces quicker than a school of sharks if you overreach yourself. Tell the Lord Daimyo! Blackthorn deliberately bowed low to the platform, and felt the chill sweat beginning to pearl as he committed himself irrevocably to his course of action. Father Sebastião knew that his training should make him impervious to the pirate's insults, and the obvious plan to discredit him in front of the daimyo. But, for the first time, it did not, and he felt lost. When Mura's messenger had brought news of the ship to his mission in the neighbouring province, he had been rocked by the implications.
It can't be Dutch or English, he had thought.
There had never been a heretic ship in the Pacific, except those of the archdevil corsair, Drake, and never one here in Asia. The routes were secret and guarded. At once he had prepared to leave, and had sent an urgent carrier pigeon message to his superior in Osaka, wishing that he could first have consulted with him, knowing that he was young, almost untried and new to Japan, barely 2 years here, not yet ordained, and not competent to deal with this emergency. He had rushed to Anjiro, hoping and praying that the news was untrue. But the ship was Dutch and the pilot English, and all of his loathing for the satanic heresies of Luther, Calvin, Henry VIII, and the archfiend Elizabeth, his bastard daughter, had overwhelmed him, and still swamped his judgment.
Priest, translate what the pirate said, he heard the daimyo say.
Oh, blessed Mother of God, help me to do thy will. Help me to be strong in front of the daimyo, and give me the gift of tongues, and let me convert him to the true faith.
Father Sebastião gathered his wits and began to speak more confidently. Blackthorn listened carefully, trying to pick out the words and meanings. The father used England and Blackthorn and pointed at the ship, which lay nicely at anchor in the harbour.
How did you get here? Father Sebastião said.
by Magellan's Pass. This is the 136th day from there. Tell the daimyo, you're lying. Magellan's Pass is secret. You came via Africa and India. You'll have to tell the truth eventually. They use torture here. The pass was secret. A Portuguese sold us a rutter. One of your own people sold you out for a little Judas gold. You're all manure. Now all English warships and Dutch warships know the way through to the Pacific. There's a fleet, 20 English ships of the line, 60 cannon warships, attacking Manila right now. Your empire's finished. You're lying. Yes, Blackthorn thought, knowing there was no way to prove the lie except to go to Manila. That fleet will harry your sea lanes and stamp out your colonies. There's another Dutch fleet due here any week now. The Spanish-Portuguese pig is back in his pigsty, and your Jesuit general's penis is in his anus, where it belongs. He turned away and bowed low to the daimyo. God curse you, and your filthy mouth! Ano mono wan ani amus te oru! The daimyo snapped impatiently. The priest spoke more quickly, harder, and said Magellan and Manila. But Blackthorn thought that the daimyo and his lieutenants did not seem to understand too clearly. Yabu was wearying of this trial. He looked out into the harbour, to the ship that had obsessed him ever since he had received Omi's secret message, and he wondered again if it was the gift from the gods that he hoped.
"Have you inspected the cargo yet, Omi-san?"
he had asked this morning, as soon as he had arrived, mud-spattered and very weary.
"No, Lord. I thought it best to seal up the ship until you came personally. But the holds are filled with crates and bales. I hope I did it correctly. Here are all their keys. I confiscated them."
"Good."
Yabu had come from Edo, Toranaga's capital city, more than 100 miles away, post-haste, furtively, and at great personal risk, and it was vital that he return as quickly. The journey had taken almost 2 days over foul roads and spring-filled streams, partly on horseback and partly by palanquin.
"I'll go to the ship at once." "You should see the strangers, Lord,"
Omi had said with a laugh.
"They're incredible. Most of them have blue eyes, like Siamese cats, and golden hair. But the best news of all is that they're pirates."
Omi had told him about the priest, and what the priest had related about these corsairs, and what the pirate had said and what had happened, and his excitement had tripled. Yabu had conquered his impatience to go aboard the ship and break the seals. Instead, he had bathed and changed and ordered the barbarians brought in front of him.
"You, priest,"
he said, his voice sharp, hardly able to understand the priest's bad Japanese.
"Why is he so angry with you?"
"He's evil. Pirate. He worship devil."
Yabu leaned over to Omi, the man on his left.
"Can you understand what he's saying, nephew? Is he lying? What do you think?"
"I don't know, Lord. Who knows what barbarians really believe? I imagine the priest thinks the pirate is a devil worshipper. Of course, that's all nonsense."
Yabu turned back to the priest, detesting him. He wished that he could crucify him today and obliterate Christianity from his domain once and for all. But he could not. Though he and all other daimyos had total power in their own domains, they were still subject to the overriding authority of the Council of Regents, the military ruling junta to whom the Taiko had legally willed his power during his son's minority, and subject, too, to edicts the Taiko had issued in his lifetime, which were all still legally in force. One of these, promulgated years ago, dealt with the Portuguese barbarians and ordered that they were all protected persons, and within reason, their religion was to be tolerated and their priests allowed, within reason, to proselytize and convert.
"You, priest, what else did the pirate say? What was he saying to you? Hurry up! Have you lost your tongue?"
"Pirate says bad things, bad, about more pirate warboatings, Many.
What do you mean? War boatings?
Sorry, Lord. I don't understand.
War boatings doesn't make sense, ne?
Ah, pirates says other ships war are in Manila, in Philippines.
Umesan, do you understand what he's talking about?
No, Lord. His accent's appalling. It's almost gibberish. Is he saying that more pirate ships are east of Japan?
You, priest, are these pirate ships off our coast? East, eh?
Yes, Lord, but I think he's lying. He says at Manila.
I don't understand you. Where's Manila?
East, a many days' journey.
If any pirate ships come here, we'll give them a pleasant welcome, wherever Manila is.
Please, excuse me. I don't understand.
Never mind,
Yabu said, his patience at an end. He had already decided the strangers were to die, and he relished the prospect. Obviously, these men did not come within the Taiko's edict that specified Portuguese barbarians. And anyway, they were pirates. As long as he could remember, he had hated barbarians, their stench and filthiness and disgusting meat-eating habits, their stupid religion and arrogance and detestable manners. More than that, he was shamed, as was every daimyo, by their stranglehold over this land of the gods. A state of war had existed between China and Japan for centuries. China would allow no trade. Chinese silk cloth was vital to make the long, hot, humid Japanese summer bearable. For generations, only a minuscule amount of contraband cloth had slipped through the net and was available, at huge cost, in Japan. Then, 60-odd years ago, the barbarians had first arrived. The Chinese emperor in Peking gave them a tiny permanent base at Macau in southern China and agreed to trade silks for silver. Japan had silver in abundance. Soon trade was flourishing. Both countries prospered. The middlemen, the Portuguese, grew rich, and their priests, Jesuits mostly, soon became vital to the trade. Only the priests managed to learn to speak Chinese and Japanese, and therefore could act as negotiators and interpreters. As trade blossomed, the priests became more essential. Now the yearly trade was huge and touched the life of every samurai. So the priests had to be tolerated, and the spread of their religion tolerated, or the barbarians would sail away, and trade would cease. By now there were a number of very important Christian daimyos, and many hundreds of thousands of converts, most of whom were in Kyushu, the southern island that was nearest to China, and contained the Portuguese port of Nagasaki.
Yes, Yabu thought. We must tolerate the priests and the Portuguese, but not these barbarians, the new ones, the unbelievable golden-haired, blue-eyed ones.
His excitement filled him. Now at last he could satisfy his curiosity as to how well a barbarian would die when put to torment. And he had 11 men, 11 different tests, to experiment with. He never questioned why the agony of others pleasured him. He only knew that it did, and therefore it was something to be sought and enjoyed.
Yabu said, "This ship, alien, non-Portuguese and pirate, is confiscated with all it contains. All pirates are sentenced to immediate..."
His mouth dropped open as he saw the pirate leader suddenly leap at the priest and rip the wooden crucifix from his belt, snap it into pieces and hurl the pieces on the ground, then shout something very loudly. The pirate immediately knelt and bowed low to him as the guards jumped forward, swords raised.
"Stop! Don't kill him!"
Yabu was astounded that anyone could have the impertinence to act with such lack of manners in front of him.
"These barbarians are beyond belief."
"Yes,"
Omi said, his mind flooding with the questions that such an action implied. The priest was still kneeling, staring fixedly at the pieces of the cross. They watched as his hand reached out shakily and picked up the violated wood. He said something to the pirate, his voice low, almost gentle. His eyes closed, he steepled his fingers, and his lips began to move slowly. The pirate leader was looking up at them motionlessly, pale blue eyes unblinking, cat-like, in front of his rabble crew.
Yabu said, Omi-san, first I want to go on the ship. Then we'll begin.
His voice thickened as he contemplated the pleasure he had promised himself.
I want to begin with that red-haired one on the end of the line, the small man.
Omi leaned closer and lowered his excited voice.
Please excuse me, but this has never happened before, sire. Not since the Portuguese barbarians came here. Isn't the crucifix their sacred symbol? Aren't they always deferential to their priests? Don't they always kneel to them openly? Just like our Christians? Haven't the priests absolute control over them? Come to your point. We all detest the Portuguese, sire. Except the Christians among us, ne? Perhaps these barbarians are worth more to you alive than dead.
How?
Because they're unique. They're anti-Christian. Perhaps a wise man could find a way to use their hatred or irreligiousness to our advantage. They're your property to do with as you wish. Ne?
Yes. And I want them in torment,
Yabu thought.
Yes. But you can enjoy that at any time. Listen to Omi. He's a good counselor. But is he to be trusted now? Does he have a secret reason for saying this? Think.
Ikawa Jikyu is Christian,
he heard his nephew say, naming his hated enemy. One of Ishido's kinsmen and allies, who sat on his western borders.
Doesn't this filthy priest have his home there? Perhaps these barbarians could give you the key to unlock Ikawa's whole province. Perhaps Ishido's.
Perhaps even Lord Toranaga's,
Omi added delicately. Yabu studied Omi's face, trying to reach what was behind it. Then his eyes went to the ship. He had no doubt now that it had been sent by the gods.
Yes.
But was it as a gift or a plague? He put away his own pleasure for the security of his clan.
I agree. But first break these pirates. Teach them manners. Particularly him.
Good sweet Jesus, death,
Fink muttered.
We should say a prayer,
Van Neck said.
We've just said one.
Perhaps we'd better say another. Lord God in heaven! I could use a pint of brandy.
They were crammed into a deep cellar, one of the many that the fishermen used to store sun-dried fish. Samurai had herded them across the square, down a ladder, and now they were locked underground. The cellar was 5 paces long and 5 wide and 4 deep, with an earthen floor and walls. The ceiling was made of planks, with a foot of earth above and a single trapdoor set into it.
Get off my foot, you god-cursed ape! Shut your face, shit-picker,
Peter Schoen said genially.
Hey, Vink, move up a little, you toothless old fart. You've got more room than anyone. Oh, God, I could use a cold beer. Move up! I can't, Peter Schoen. We're tighter than a virgin's ass here.
It's the Captain General. He's got all the space. Give him a shove. Wake him up!
Matsaka said.
Hey, what's the matter? Leave me alone. What's going on? I'm sick. I've got to lie down. Where are we?
Leave him alone. He's sick. Come on, Matsaka. Get up, for the love of God.
Vink angrily pulled Matsaka up and shoved him against the wall. There was not room enough for them all to lie down, or even to sit comfortably at the same time. The Captain General, Paolo Spilbacher, was lying full length under the trap door, where there was the best air, his head propped on his bundled cloak. Blackthorn was leaning against a corner, staring up at the trap door. The crew had left him alone, and stayed clear of him uneasily, as best they could, recognizing from long experience his mood, and the brooding, explosive violence that always lurked just below his quiet exterior. Matsaika lost his temper and smashed his fist into Vink's groin.
Leave me alone, or I'll kill you, you bastard!
Vink flew at him, but Blackthorn grabbed both of them and rammed their heads against the wall.
Shut up, all of you, he said softly.
They did as they were ordered.
We'll split into watches. One watch sleeps, one sits, and one stands. Spielbacher lies down until he's fit. That corner's the latrine.
He divided them up. When they had rearranged themselves, it was more bearable.
We'll have to break out of here within a day, or we'll be too weak, Blackthorn thought. When they bring the ladder back to give us food or water. It will have to be tonight or tomorrow night. Why did they put us here? We're no threat. We could help the daimyo. Will he understand? It was my only way to show him that the priests are real enemy. Will he understand? The priest had.
Perhaps God may forgive your sacrilege, but I won't.
Father Sebastião had said very quietly.
I will never rest until you and your evil are obliterated.
The sweat was dribbling down his cheeks and chin. He wiped it away absently, ears tuned to the cellar, as they would be when he was aboard and sleeping, or off watch and drifting. Just enough to try to hear the danger before it happened.
We'll have to break out and take the ship.
I wonder what Felicity's doing. And the children. Let's see.
Tudor's 7 years old now, and Lisbeth is...
We're 1 year and 11 months and 6 days from Amsterdam. Add 37 days provisioning and coming from Chatham to there. Add, lastly, the 11 days that she was alive before the embarkation at Chatham. That's her age exactly, if all's well. All should be well. Felicity will be cooking and guarding and cleaning and chattering as the kids grow up, as strong and fearless as their mother. It will be fine to be home again. To walk together along the shore and in the forests and glades and beauty that is England. Over the years he had trained himself to think about them as characters in a play, people that you loved and bled for, the play never ending. Otherwise the hurt of being away would be too much. He could almost count his days at home in the 11 years of marriage.
They're few, he thought. Too few. It's a hard life for a woman, Felicity, he had said before.
And she had said, any life is hard for a woman. She was 17 then, and tall, and her hair was long and sensual. His ears told him to beware. The men were sitting or leaning or trying to sleep. Vink and Petersen, good friends, were talking quietly. Vernec was staring into space with the others. Spielbacher was half awake, and Blackthorn thought the man was stronger than he let everyone believe. There was a sudden silence as they heard the footsteps overhead. The footsteps stopped, muted voices in the harsh, strange-sounding language. Blackthorn thought he recognized the samurai's voice.
Umi-san? Yes, that was his name.
But he could not be certain. In a moment, the voices stopped and the footsteps went away.
You think they'll feed us, pilot?
Sonk said.
Yes. I could use a drink. Cold beer, by God,
Petersen said.
Shut up, Vink said. You're enough to make a man sweat.
Blackthorn was conscious of his soaking shirt. And the stench.
By the Lord God, I could use a bath, he thought.
And abruptly he smiled, remembering. Mura and the others had carried him into the warm room that day and laid him on a stone bench, his limbs still numb and slow-moving. The three women, led by the old crone, had begun to undress him and he had tried to stop them, but every time he moved, one of the men would stab a nerve and hold him powerless, and however much he raved and cursed, they continued to undress him until he was naked. It was not that he was ashamed of being naked in front of a woman. It was just that undressing was always done in private. And that was the custom. And he did not like being undressed by anyone, let alone these uncivilized natives. But to be undressed publicly like a helpless baby, and to be washed everywhere like a baby with warm, soapy-scented water, while they chattered and smiled as he lay on his back, was too much. Then he had become erect, and as much as he tried to stop it from happening, the worse it became. At least he thought so, but the women did not. Their eyes became bigger, and he began to blush.
"Jesus, Lord God, the one and only. I can't be blushing."
But he was, and this seemed to increase his size, and the old woman clapped her hands in wonder, and said something to which they all nodded, and she shook her head, awed, and said something else to which they nodded even more. Mura had said with enormous gravity,
"Captain-san, mother-san, thank you. The best her life. Now die happy."
And he and they had all bowed as one, and then he, Blackthorn, had seen how funny it was, and he had begun to laugh. They were startled, then they were laughing too, and his laughter took his strength away, and the crone was a little sad and said so, and this made him laugh more, and them also. Then they laid him gently into the vast heat of the deep water, and soon he could bear it no longer, and they laid him gasping on the bench once more. The women had dried him, and then an old blind man had come. Blackthorn had never known massage. At first, he had tried to resist the probing fingers, but then their magic seduced him, and soon he was almost purring like a cat as the fingers found the knots and unlocked the blood or elixir that lurked beneath skin and muscle and sinew. Then he had been helped to bed, strangely weak, half in dream, and the girl was there. She was patient with him, and after sleeping, when he had strength, he took her with care, even though it had been so long. He had not asked her name, and in the morning when Mura, tense and very frightened, had pulled him out of sleep, she was gone. Blackthorn sighed.
"Life is marvelous," he thought.
In the cellar, Spilbercher was querulous again. Matsyker was nursing his head and moaning, not from pain but from fear. The boy croaked near breaking, and Jan Roper said,
"What's there to smile about, Pilot?"
"Go to hell."
"With respect, Pilot,"
Van Neck said carefully, bringing into the open what was foremost in their minds.
"You were most unwise to attack the priest in front of the rotten yellow bastard."
There was general, though carefully expressed, agreement.
"If you hadn't, I don't think we'd be in this filthy mess."
Van Neck did not go near Blackthorn.
"All you've got to do is put your head in the dust when the Lord Bastard's around, and they're as meek as lambs."
He waited for a reply, but Blackthorn made none, just turned back to the trapdoor. It was as though nothing had been said. Their unease increased. Paulus Spilbercher lifted himself on one elbow with difficulty.
"What are you talking about, Bacchus?"
Van Neck went over to him, and explained about the priest and the cross and what had happened, and why they were here, his eyes hurting today worse than ever.
"Yes, that was dangerous, Pilot Major,"
Spilbercher said.
"Yes, I'd say quite wrong. Pass me some water. Now the Jesuits will give us no peace at all."
"You should have broken his neck, Pilot. Jesuits will give us no peace anyway,"
Jan Roper said.
"They're filthy lice, and we're here in this stinkhole as God's punishment."
"That's nonsense, Roper,"
Spilbercher said.
"We're here because it is God's punishment. We should have burned all the churches in Santa Magdalena, not just two.
We should have.
Cesspits of Satan."
Spilbercher slapped weakly at a fly.
"The Spanish troops were regrouping, and we were outnumbered 15-1. Give me some water. We'd sacked the town and got the plunder and rubbed their noses in the dust. If we'd stayed, we would have been killed. For God's sake, give me some water, someone. We'd all have been killed if we hadn't retreat."
"What does it matter if you're doing the work of God?"
"We failed him."
"Perhaps we're here to do God's work," Van Neck said, placatingly.
For Roper was a good, though zealous man, a clever merchant, and his partner's son.
Perhaps we can show the natives here the error of their papist ways. Perhaps we could convert them to the true faith.
Quite right, Spielbacher said.
He still felt weak, but his strength was returning.
I think you should have consulted Bacchus, Pilot Major. After all, he's chief merchant. He's very good at parleying with savages. Pass the water, I said.
There isn't any, Paulus.
Van Neck's gloom increased.
They've given us no food or water. We haven't even got a pot to piss in.
Well, ask for one. And some water. But in heaven, I'm thirsty. Ask for water. You.
Me? Vink asked.
Yes, you.
Vink looked at Blackthorn, but Blackthorn just watched the trapdoor obliviously. So Vink stood under the opening and shouted,
Hey! You up there! Give us God-cursed water! We want food and water!
There was no answer. He shouted again. No answer. The others gradually took up the shouts. All except Blackthorn. Soon their panic and the nausea of their close confinement crept into their voices, and they were howling like wolves. The trapdoor opened. Ermi looked down at them. Beside him was Mura. And the priest.
Water and food, by God! Let us out of here!
Soon they were all screaming again. Ermi motioned to Mura, who nodded and left. A moment later, Mura returned with another fisherman, carrying a large barrel between them. They emptied the contents, rotting fish offal and seawater, onto the heads of the prisoners. The men in the cellar scattered and tried to escape, but all of them could not. Spielbacher was choking, almost drowned. Some of the men slipped and were trampled on. Blackthorn had not moved from the corner. He just stared up at Ermi, hating him. Then Ermi began talking. There was a cowed silence now, broken only by coughing and Spielbacher's retching. When Ermi had finished, the priest nervously came to the opening.
These are Kashigi Omi's orders. You will begin to act like decent human beings. You will make no more noise. If you do, next time 5 barrels will be poured into the cellar. Then 10, then 20. You will be given food and water 2x a day. When you have learned to behave, you will be allowed up into the world of men. Lord Yabu has graciously spared all your lives, providing you serve him loyally. All except one. One of you is to die at dusk. You are to choose who it will be. But you, he pointed at Blackthorn, you are not to be the one chosen. Ill at ease, the priest took a deep breath, half bowed to the samurai, and stepped back. Ermi peered down into the pit. He could see Blackthorn's eyes, and he felt the hatred.
It will take much to break that man's spirit, he thought. No matter. There's time enough.
The trap door slammed into place. Chapter 3 Yabu lay in the hot bath, more content, more confident than he had ever been in his life. The ship had revealed its wealth, and this wealth gave him a power that he had never dreamed possible.
I want everything taken ashore tomorrow, he had said. Repack the muskets in their crates. Camouflage everything with nets or sacking. 500 muskets, he thought exultantly, with more gunpowder and shot than Toranaga has in all the 8 provinces. And 20 cannon, 5,000 cannonballs with an abundance of ammunition. Fire arrows by the crate. All of the best European quality. Mura, you will provide porters. Igorashi-san, I want all this armament, including the cannon, in my castle at Mishima forthwith. In secret. You will be responsible. Yes, Lord.
They had been in the main hold of the ship, and everyone had gaped at him. Igorashi, a tall, lithe, one-eyed man, his chief retainer. Tsukimoto, his quartermaster, together with 10 sweat-stained villagers who had opened the crates under Mura's supervision, and his personal bodyguard of 4 samurai. He knew they did not understand his exhilaration or the need to be clandestine.
Good, he thought.
When the Portuguese had first discovered Japan in 1542, they had introduced muskets and gunpowder. Within 18 months, the Japanese were manufacturing them. The quality was not nearly as good as the European equivalent, but that did not matter, because guns were considered merely a novelty, and for a long time used only for hunting. And even for that, bows were far more accurate. Also, more important, Japanese warfare was almost ritual. Hand-to-hand individual combat, the sword being the most honorable weapon. The use of guns was considered cowardly and dishonorable, and completely against the samurai code, Bushido, the way of the warrior, which bound samurai to fight with honor, to live with honor, and to die with honor. To have undying, unquestioned loyalty to one's feudal lord, to be fearless of death, even to seek it in his service, and to be proud of one's own name and keep it unsullied. For years, Yabu had had a secret theory.
At long last, he thought exultantly, you can expand it and put it into effect. 500 chosen samurai, armed with muskets, but trained as a unit, spearheading your 12,000 conventional troops, supported by 20 cannon used in a special way by special men, also trained as a unit. A new strategy for a new era. In the coming war, guns could be decisive.
What about Bushido? The ghosts of his ancestors had always asked him.
What about Bushido?
He had always asked them back. They had never answered. Never in his wildest dreams had he thought he'd ever be able to afford 500 guns. But now he had them for nothing, and he alone knew how to use them. But whose side to use them for? Torunaga's or Ishido's? Or should he wait, and perhaps be the eventual victor?
Igarashi-san, you'll travel by night and maintain strict security. Yes, Lord. This is to remain secret, Mura, or the village will be obliterated.
Nothing will be said, Lord. I can speak for my village. I cannot speak for the journey or for other villages. Who knows where there are spies? But nothing will be said by us.
Next, Yabu had gone to the strongroom. It contained what he presumed to be pirate plunder. Silver and gold plate, cups, candelabra and ornaments, some religious paintings in ornate frames. A chest contained women's clothes, elaborately embroidered with gold thread and colored stones.
I'll have the silver and gold melted into ingots and put in the treasury,
Tsukimoto had said. He was a neat, pedantic man in his 40s who was not a samurai. Years ago, he had been a Buddhist warrior priest, but the Taiko, the Lord Protector, had stamped out his monastery in a campaign to purge the land of certain Buddhist militant warrior monasteries and sects that would not acknowledge his absolute suzerainty. Tsukimoto had bribed his way out of that early death and become a peddler, at length a minor merchant in rice. 10 years ago, he had joined Yabu's commissariat, and now he was indispensable.
As to the clothes, perhaps the gold thread and gems have value. With your permission, I'll have them packed and sent to Nagasaki with anything else I can salvage.
The port of Nagasaki, on the southernmost coast of the South Island of Kyushu, was the legal entrepot and trading market of the Portuguese.
The barbarians might pay well for these odds and ends. Good. What about the bales in the other hold? They all contain a heavy cloth, quite useless to us, sire, with no market value at all. But this should please you.
Tsukimoto had opened the strongbox. The box contained 20,000 minted silver pieces, Spanish doubloons, the best quality. Yabu stirred in his bath. He wiped the sweat from his face and neck with the small white towel and sank deeper into the hot, scented water.
If 3 days ago, he told himself, a soothsayer had forecast that all this would happen, you would have fed him his tongue for telling impossible lies.
3 days ago, he had been in Edo, Toranaga's capital. Omi's message had arrived at dusk. Obviously, the ship had to be investigated at once, but Toranaga was still away in Osaka for the final confrontation with General Lord Ishido, and in his absence had invited Yabu and all friendly neighboring daimyos to wait until his return. Such an invitation could not be refused without dire results. Yabu knew that he and the other independent daimyos and their families were merely added protection for Toranaga's safety. And though, of course, the word would never be used, they were hostages against Toranaga's safe return from the impregnable enemy fortress at Osaka, where the meeting was being held. Toranaga was president of the Council of Regents, which the Daiko had appointed on his deathbed to rule the empire during the minority of his son, Yeimon, now 7 years old. There were 5 regents, all eminent daimyos, but only Toranaga and Ishido had real power. Yabu had carefully considered all the reasons for going to Anjiro, the risks involved, and the reasons for staying. Then he had sent for his wife and his favorite consort. A consort was a formal, legal mistress. A man could have as many consorts as he wished, but only one wife at one time.
My nephew Omi has just sent secret word that a barbarian ship came ashore at Anjiro.
One of the black ships?
His wife had asked excitedly. These were the huge, incredibly rich trading ships that plied annually with the monsoon winds between Nagasaki and the Portuguese colony of Macau, that lay almost 1,000 miles south on the China mainland.
No, but it might be rich. I'm leaving immediately. You're to say that I've been taken sick and cannot be disturbed for any reason. I'll be back in 5 days.
That's incredibly dangerous, his wife warned. Lord Taranaga gave specific orders for us to stay. I'm sure he'll make another compromise with Ishido, and he's too powerful to offend. Sire, we could never guarantee that someone won't suspect the truth. There are spies everywhere. If Toranaga returned and found you'd gone, your absence would be misinterpreted. Your enemies would poison his mind against you. Yes, his consort added. Please excuse me, but you must listen to the lady, your wife. She's right. Lord Toranaga would never believe that you'd disobeyed just to look at a barbarian ship. Please send someone else.
But this isn't an ordinary barbarian ship. It's not Portuguese. Listen to me. Omi says it's from a different country. These men talk a different sounding language among themselves, and they have blue eyes and golden hair.
Omi-san's gone mad, or he's drunk too much sake, his wife said.
This is much too important to joke about, for him and for you.
His wife had bowed and apologized, and said that he was quite right to correct her, but that the remark was not meant in jest. She was a small, thin woman, 10 years older than he, who had given him a child a year for 8 years until her womb had dried up, and of these, 5 had been sons. 3 had become warriors and died bravely in the war against China. Another had become a Buddhist priest, and the last, now 19, he despised. His wife, the Lady Yuriko, was the only woman he had ever been afraid of, the only woman he had ever valued, except his mother, now dead. And she ruled his house with a silken lash.
Again, please excuse me, she said. Does Omi-san detail the cargo?
No. He didn't examine it, Yuriko-san. He says he sealed the ship at once because it was so unusual. There's never been a non-Portuguese ship before, ne? He says also it's a fighting ship with 20 cannon on its decks.
Ah! Then someone must go immediately.
I'm going myself.
Please reconsider. Send Mizuno. Your brother's clever and wise. I implore you not to go.
Mizuno's weak and not to be trusted.
Then order him to commit seppuku and have done with him, she said harshly.
Seppuku, sometimes called harakiri, the ritual suicide by disembowelment, was the only way a samurai could expiate a shame, a sin, or a fault with honor, and was the sole prerogative of the samurai caste. All samurai, women as well as men, were prepared from infancy, either for the act itself or to take part in the ceremony as a second. Women committed seppuku only with a knife in the throat.
Later, not now, Yabu told his wife.
Then send Tsukimoto. He's certainly to be trusted.
If Toranaga hadn't ordered all wives and consorts to stay here too, I'd send you. But that would be too risky. I have to go. I have no option. Yuriko-san, you tell me my treasury's empty. You say I've no more credit with the filthy moneylenders. Tsukimoto says we're getting the maximum tax out of my peasants. I have to have more horses, armaments, weapons, and more samurai. Perhaps the ship will supply the means.
Lord Toranaga's orders were quite clear, sire. If he comes back and finds...
Yes, if he comes back, lady. I still think he's put himself into a trap. The Lord Ishido has 80,000 samurai in and around Osaka Castle alone. For Toranaga to go there with a few hundred men was the act of a madman.
He's much too shrewd to risk himself unnecessarily, she said confidently.
If I were Ishido and I had him in my grasp, I would kill him at once.
Yes, Yuriko said. But the mother of the heir is still hostage in Edo until Toranaga returns. General Lord Ishido dare not touch Toranaga until she's safely back at Osaka.
I'd kill him. If the Lady Ochiba lives or dies, it doesn't matter. The heir's safe in Osaka. With Toranaga dead, the succession is certain. Toranaga's the only real threat to the heir, the only one with a chance at using the Council of Regents, usurping the Taiko's power, and killing the boy.
Please excuse me, sire, but perhaps General Lord Ishido can carry the other three regents with him and impeach Toranaga. And that's the end of Toranaga, ne?
His consort said.
Yes, lady. If Ishido could, he would. But I don't think he can. Yet. No can Toranaga. The Daiko picked the five regents too cleverly. They despise each other so much, it's almost impossible for them to agree on anything.
Before taking power, the five great daimyos had publicly sworn eternal allegiance to the dying Daiko, and to his son and his line, forever. And they had taken public, sacred oaths, agreeing to unanimous rule in the council, and vowed to pass over the realm intact to Yeimon when he came of age on his 15th birthday.
Unanimous rule means nothing really can be changed until Yeimon inherits.
But someday, sire, four regents will join against one, through jealousy, fear, or ambition, ne? The four will bend the Taiko's orders just enough for war, ne?
Yes, but it will be a small war, lady, and the one will always be smashed, and his land divided up by the victors, who will then have to appoint a fifth regent, and, in time, it will be four against one, and again the one will be smashed, and his lands forfeit, all as the Daiko planned. My only problem is to decide who will be the one this time. Ishido or Toranaga?
Toranaga will be the one isolated.
Why?
The others fear him too much, because they all know he secretly wants to be shogun. However much he protests, he doesn't.
Shogun was the ultimate rank a mortal could achieve in Japan. Shogun meant supreme military dictator. Only one daimyo at a time could possess the title. And only His Imperial Highness, the reigning emperor, the divine son of heaven, who lived in seclusion with the imperial families at Kyoto, could grant the title. With the appointment of shogun went absolute power, the emperor's seal and mandate. The shogun ruled in the emperor's name. All power was derived from the emperor because he was directly descended from the gods. Therefore, any daimyo who opposed the shogun was automatically in rebellion against the throne and at once outcast and all his lands forfeit. The reigning emperor was worshipped as a divinity because he was descended in an unbroken line from the sun goddess, Amaterasu Omikami, one of the children of the gods Izanagi and Izanami, who had formed the islands of Japan from the firmament. By divine right, the ruling emperor owned all the land and ruled and was obeyed without question. But in practice, for more than six centuries, real power had rested behind the throne. Six centuries ago, there had been a schism when two of the three great rival semi-regal samurai families, the Minowara, the Hujimoto, and Takashima, backed rival claimants to the throne and plunged the realm into civil war. After 60 years, the Minowara prevailed over the Takashima, and the Hujimoto, the family that had stayed neutral, bided its time. From then on, jealously guarding their rule, the Minowara shoguns dominated the realm, decreed their shogunate hereditary, and began to intermarry some of their daughters with the imperial line. The emperor and the entire imperial court were kept completely isolated in walled palaces and gardens in the small enclave at Kyoto, most times in penury, and their activities perpetually confined to observing the rituals of Shinto, the ancient animistic religion of Japan, and to intellectual pursuits such as calligraphy, painting, philosophy, and poetry. The court of the Son of Heaven was easy to dominate because though it possessed all the land, it had no revenue. Only daimyos, samurai, possessed revenue and the right to tax. And so it was that although all members of the imperial court were above all samurai in rank, they still existed on a stipend granted the court at the whim of the shogun, the kampak, the civil chief advisor, or the ruling military junta of the day. Few were generous. Some emperors had even had to barter their signatures for food. Many times, there was not enough money for a coronation. At length, the Minowara shoguns lost their power to others, to Takashima or Hujimoto descendants. And as the civil wars continued unabated over the centuries, the emperor became more and more the creature of the daimyo, who was strong enough to obtain physical possession of Kyoto. The moment the new conqueror of Kyoto had slaughtered the ruling shogun and his line, he would, providing he was Minowara, Takashima, or Hujimoto, with humility swear allegiance to the throne and humbly invite the powerless emperor to grant him the now vacant rank of shogun. Then, like his predecessors, he would try to extend his rule outward from Kyoto until he, in his turn, was swallowed by another. Emperors married, abdicated, or ascended the throne at the whim of the shogunate. But always the reigning emperor's bloodline was inviolate and unbroken. So the shogun was all-powerful, until he was overthrown. Many were unseated over the centuries as the realm splintered into ever smaller factions. For the last 100 years, no single daimyo had ever had enough power to become shogun. 12 years ago, the peasant, General Nakamura, had had the power, and he had obtained the mandate from the present emperor, Go-Nijo. But Nakamura could not be granted shogun rank, however much he desired it, because he was born a peasant. He had to be content with the much lesser civilian title of Kampak, chief advisor, and later, when he resigned that title to his infant son, Yeimon, though keeping all power, as was quite customary, he had to be content with Taiko. By historic custom, only the descendants of the sprawling, ancient, semi-divine families of the Minowara, Takashima, and Hujimoto were entitled to the rank of shogun. Torunaga was descended from the Minowara. Yabu could trace his lineage to a vague and minor branch of the Takashima, enough of a connection if ever he could become supreme.
"Eh, lady," Yabu said. "Of course Toranaga wants to be shogun, but he'll never achieve it. The other regions despise and fear him. They'll neutralize him, as the Daiko planned."
He leaned forward and studied his wife intently.
"You say Toranaga's going to lose to Ishido?"
"He will be isolated, yes. But in the end, I don't think he'll lose, sire.
I beg you not to disobey Lord Toranaga, and not to leave Edo just to examine the barbarian ship, no matter how unusual Omi-san says it is. Please send Tsukimoto to Anjiro."
"What if the ship contains bullion, silver, or gold? Would you trust Tsukimoto or any of our officers with it?"
"No,"
his wife had said. So that night he had slipped out of Edo secretly, with only 50 men, and now he had wealth and power beyond his dreams and unique captives, one of whom was going to die tonight. He had arranged for a courtesan and a boy to be ready later. At dawn tomorrow, he would return to Edo. By sunset tomorrow, the guns and the bullion would begin their secret journey.
"Eh, the guns," he thought exultantly. "The guns and the plan together will give me the power to make Ishido win, or Toranaga, whomever I chose. Then I'll become a regent in the loser's place, ne? Then the most powerful regent. Why not even shogun? Yes, it's all possible now."
He let himself drift pleasantly.
"How to use the 20,000 pieces of silver? I can rebuild the castle keep, and buy special horses for the cannon, and expand our espionage web. What about Ikawa Jikyu? Would 1,000 pieces be enough to bribe Ikawa Jikyu's cooks to poison him? More than enough. 500, even 100 in the right hands would be plenty. Whose?"
The afternoon sun was slanting through the small window set into the stone walls. The bathwater was very hot and heated by a wood fire built into the outside wall. This was Omi's house, and it stood on a small hill overlooking the village and the harbour. The garden within its walls was neat and serene and worthy. The bathroom door opened. The blind man bowed.
"Kashiki Omi-san sent me, sire. I am Suo, his masseur."
He was tall and very thin and old, his face wrinkled.
"Good."
Yabu had always had a terror of being blinded. As long as he could remember, he had had dreams of waking in blackness, knowing it was sunlight, feeling the warmth but not seeing, opening his mouth to scream, knowing that it was dishonorable to scream, but screaming even so. Then the real awakening and the sweat streaming. But this horror of blindness seemed to increase his pleasure at being massaged by the sightless. He could see the jagged scar on the man's right temple and the deep cleft in the skull below it.
"That's a sword cut," he told himself. "Did that cause his blindness? Was he a samurai once? For whom? Is he a spy?"
Yabu knew that the man would have been searched very carefully by his guards before being allowed to enter, so he had no fear of a concealed weapon. His own prized longsword was within reach, an ancient blade made by the master swordsmith Murasama. He watched the old man take off his cotton kimono and hang it up without seeking the peg. There were more sword scars on his chest. His loincloth was very clean. He knelt, waiting patiently. Yabu got out of the bath when he was ready and lay on the stone bench. The old man dried Yabu carefully, put fragrant oil on his hands, and began to knead the muscles in the daimyo's neck and back. Tension began to vanish as the very strong fingers moved over Yabu, probing deeply with surprising skill.
"That's good. Very good," he said after a while. "Thank you, Yabu-sama,"
Suo said. Sama, meaning lord, was an obligatory politeness when addressing a superior.
Have you served Omi-san long?
3 years, sire. He is very kind to an old man.